Our first speaker in the middle here, David Thunder, is a researcher and lecturer in political and social philosophy at the Institute for Culture and Society at the University of Navarra, Pamplona, Spain. He has a BA and an MA from University College Dublin and a PhD in political science from the University of Notre Dame, South Bend, Indiana, USA. David's academic writings include Citizenship and the Pursuit of the Worthy Life, Cambridge University Press, 2014, The Ethics of Citizenship in the 21st Century, edited volume, Springer, 2017, and numerous articles in international peer-reviewed journals, such as the American Journal of Political Science, Political Theory, the Journal of Social Philosophy, and the Journal of Business Ethics. His writings cover a wide range of questions, including the pros and cons of individualism, the ethics of financial trading, the complicity of citizens in collective injustice, the concept of moral impartiality, and the scope of duties of beneficence. He writes occasionally for the Irish Times and RTE's Brainstorm page. This is what the summary he gave me of the talk he's going to give. It's just a short summary. The title is Christian Humanism Under Siege, Strategies for Promoting and Defending Christian Culture in a Hostile Environment. Over the past several decades, Ireland has undergone a dramatic cultural transformation. One feature of this transformation is that whereas something like Christian humanism was once the established philosophy in both media and political circles, many aspects of Christian culture are now openly disparaged in our public sphere and are effectively repudiated in our laws and public policies. These include the sacredness of human life from conception to natural death, the authority of parents in education, in the education of their own children, heterosexual marriage as a public institution, and even the notion that one has an identifiable sex from birth. As our public culture becomes increasingly hostile toward Christian morality and the Christian way of life, it is worth asking the question, how should Christians respond to such a hostile environment? In this talk, David discusses the comparative methods and drawbacks of three possible strategies a Christian might adopt in the face of an anti-Christian culture. First, critical engagement with mainstream institutions and culture. Second, seeking special accommodations and legal exemptions for Christian citizens. And third, developing an independent, parallel culture in which Christian humanism has a better chance to grow and take root. David will suggest that there is a place for all three strategies, but that single-mindedly pursuing one strategy to the detriment of others would be unwise. Each strategy carries significant risks, but nobody promised that living a Christian life would be risk-free. So I'll hand you over now to Dr. David Thunder. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, good afternoon. I suppose we're in the afternoon. It's great to be here. I want to first of all thank the Alliance for the Defence of the Family and Marriage for inviting me here to speak. A special thanks to Seamus DeBarra for reaching out to me and asking me if I'd be interested in speaking. And he gave me a lot of leeway to choose what topic I really was interested in. And thank you for coming here and for your patience, for patiently listening. And I'm hoping that I can transmit a few ideas that you might take away and that you might find useful. I don't find myself often in the position of addressing an audience sympathetic to Christian faith and culture. Typically, my audiences are academic audiences, and by definition, academic audiences tend to be quite skeptical about Christian faith and culture. So it's a rare privilege to be able to speak sort of within the tent, if you want, of Christianity. For the most part, I don't assume anything about everyone here, because there are people here who knows who may be Jewish or not practicing any particular faith. But I do think it's clear that most people here are sympathetic to the principles of Christian humanism and to the vision of, if you like, the person and of society that we find in the Christian tradition. So you might say that I'm preaching to the converted. And that's often used as a term, a kind of derogatory term. Often it's considered that preaching to the converted is a waste of time, because they're already converted, so why are you speaking to them? But as a matter of fact, it seems to me that it's very valuable for us to reflect together on how we can build, defend and promote principles of Christian humanism. And it's an advantage that we share those principles in common, because it means that we won't be spending the next half hour on the defensive, but instead we'll be able to be constructive, and I'll be able to think about starting point being that yes, the Christian vision of the human person as made in the image and likeness of God, that this is something that is worth promoting. Now, after the shortly after the abortion referendum was passed last year, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said that we had undergone a quiet revolution in Ireland, and that Ireland was no longer divided. And which came as a surprise to me, given that a third of the voters voted against that referendum. And when I was my one and only showing on the Tonight Show. And it was very nerve-wracking, I have to say. An Irish Times journalist sitting beside me said, "But come on, David, we have a new consensus." This was her term, a new consensus. And so this kind of language, we're no longer a divided society, we have a new consensus, is basically really a denial of the social reality that we are a divided country. And a third of voters is not an insignificant number. Add a little bit more to a third and you have a half. So what has happened is that the pro-life, pro-family voice has been rendered invisible in our public culture, and in many ways, I would say, has been forgotten or cast aside. And this invisibility of the pro-life, pro-family message, it's not a total invisibility, of course, because you have certain sort of people out there fighting the cause, like David Quinn, who seems to appear on every chat show I look at. Like, it's amazing. This guy spends all his time, it seems, engaging with media. But setting aside those few exceptions, for the most part, I think it's safe to say that the Christian humanism and the Christian vision of family life in general has been cast into kind of the darkness and has been cast out of the mainstream for the most part. Now, that is not all, because that invisibility is compounded, that problem of invisibility is compounded by hostility and contempt. Practicing Catholics who actually believe what the Church teaches are treated like children in the public square. They're treated like idiots, basically, or as people who maybe had been transported forward in time from the Middle Ages and suddenly found themselves in the 21st century. And this image of the backward kind of Catholic who's a bit lost, who sort of wandered from the Middle Ages into the 21st century, is really quite perennial in the media. And so if you, for example, suggest that marriage ought to be between a man and a woman, you are accused of being a homophobe, right? Of a hating homosexual people, which is quite a leap, I would say. If you suggest that abortion is a violation of human rights, then you are accused of being patriarchal, of being against women, of not loving women, not caring for women, not having compassion for women. And I myself have experienced, I don't want to personalize it too much, but I have, if I write about anything, and it really doesn't matter what I write about, I could write about anything from Brexit to freedom of expression, it really doesn't matter. I can guarantee that there will be comments mocking me because of my institution, because I'm affiliated to a Catholic institution. That is just guaranteed. And especially if it's a Catholic institution that's viewed as a conservative Catholic institution, because the University of Navarra is an Opus Dei university. So the question is, how did we get here? How did we get to the point where a religion, a faith that was once held in great honour and was really respected in the public square, has become dishonoured, has become virtually disreputable in our public square? There are a number of factors which I won't go into, but I just mention. One is the fact that journalists, politicians, and many citizens don't know what Christianity is. What I mean to say is they have a vague idea of what it is, but their image of Christianity is distorted and reductive, because they associate Christianity with a series of proscriptions or prohibitions. They believe that Christianity is simply about stopping people from doing what they want. And that image is only partially true. There are demands for living a Christian and for being a good person. But to suggest that being a good person is just about not doing bad things is absolutely a reductive way of seeing things. There have been some well-funded campaigns against traditional ideas of marriage and the family, and including campaigns funded from abroad, and that has obviously played a role. But dare I say that the failure of the Irish Church itself, the failure of the Irish Church to be faithful to its mission, both in its teachings and in its practice, is, I would dare to say, is probably the leading factor that helps to explain how we've gotten ourselves to this point. And as a Catholic myself, I'm ashamed of how the Catholic Church in Ireland has failed in its mission over the past 30, 40 years. Even though there are lots of good Catholic priests, we've failed to catechise our children in the content of the faith. A minority of our priests have failed and have betrayed their vocation in the most horrible way, abusing innocent children. And that is going to leave a mark on our culture, inevitably. We will take decades to come back from the harms that have been done to Christian faith in this country. And I think as Catholics, we need to have the humility to recognise that a lot of the blame must be put at our own doorstep for what has happened. At the doorstep, maybe not of me personally, but corporately, at the doorstep of the Church. And we will have to gradually kind of build up that credibility again over time. But today, I want to try to... I'm not going to get into a detailed genealogy of the decline of Christianity in Ireland. That would be a bit depressing. I want to pursue a more constructive line of argument. Given that we cannot turn back the clock on the past 50 years of our history, I think it's worth asking, how might we go about rebuilding a Christian culture in a society that has grown increasingly hostile to the Christian way of life and the principles it stands for? So let me start by talking a bit about what I mean by a Christian culture. I would say that central to a Christian culture is a certain vision of the human person, which I'm going to call Christian humanism. And according to Christian humanism, the human person is made in the image and likeness of God and has a preciousness and a dignity beyond compare. And this idea I call Christian humanism, and not simply humanism, partly to recognise, in recognition of the fact that it was Christian faith and Christian theology, I would say, that really brought to the forefront the fundamental moral equality of all human beings. And you could say the Judeo-Christian worldview is part of this, but it kind of came fully to the fore with Christianity, because Christianity is not an ethnic faith. It's not based on a particular ethnicity or a particular tribe. In the pagan world, it simply was not conceivable that every single human being is precious and deserving of full respect, no matter where they were born, no matter what culture they came from, what ethnicity. This is an idea that came into the world, really, with Christianity. And St. Paul, for example, says, neither slave nor free, neither man nor woman, we are all brothers and sisters in Christ. This is a revolutionary idea that comes from Christianity, and we should not forget this. So, when I speak of building a Christian culture, I don't necessarily mean gaining converts to the Christian faith, but rather I mean promoting the values of Christian humanism, many of which can be applied and lived out by Christians and non-Christians alike. So it's perfectly conceivable for a Christian culture and for Christian humanism to be admired and to be even promoted by Jews, by atheists even, by people who perhaps are agnostics, because the vision of the human person and the preciousness of the human person and the vision of the family and the vision of marriage that Christians espouse is a vision that also has a foundation in human reason and in human society and in the natural order. So in that sense, when I talk about promoting Christian humanism, I really am talking about a vision of the human person and of society that can be affirmed by Christians and non-Christians alike. Although it's likely that Christians, because of their faith and their understanding of our relation with God, will have a deeper grasp of this idea of human dignity, a more profound grasp of it. But it's not a sectarian idea. It's not an idea that's restricted to a particular faith, the idea of Christian humanism. So what I'd like to do is, in this time that I have, is I'd like to lay out, and just to be concrete, when I talk about Christian humanism, it can be reflected in pro-life medical practices, education in the human virtues, in catechesis of children in a more religious way, in a coherent ethic of social and economic solidarity, which is so important at this time, and in the practice of heterosexual marriage and family life. The title of the talk, just to recall, is Christian Humanism Under Siege: Strategies for Promoting and Defending Christian Culture in a Hostile Environment. I'm going to lay out three strategies and just mention briefly some of their pros and cons. The first strategy is seeking special accommodations and exemptions from the law and from professional requirements. The second is engagement with mainstream institutions and culture. And the third is developing independent institutions with a Christian spirit. Okay, so let's start with the special accommodations. So one way to defend a Christian way of life in an anti-Christian or non-Christian environment is to, well, more anti-Christian, I'm thinking, limit the application of legal obligations to engage in unchristian or unjust conduct by invoking the right of conscientious objection. So, an example, a medical doctor who does not want to participate in an abortion procedure, the hospital has a general requirement that its medical doctors, gynecologists, have to assist in abortion procedures. So then what Catholics do, not only Catholics, but let's say it would be a lot of the people doing this would be Catholics, would say, sorry, my conscience doesn't permit me to participate in this procedure, so I want an exemption, conscientious opt-out. Okay, so therefore that doctor basically withdraws from that procedure, does not engage in those procedures, but they go on and they continue in the clinic, but that doctor withdraws himself or herself. Or another example, a wedding planner who says they're not going to help plan for a marriage between a man and a man. Or a baker who says, I'm not going to write on my cake, gay marriage, I love gay marriage, for example, right? Or a pharmacist who says, I'm not going to sell contraceptives that have abortifacients attached to them. Actually, it's amazing how many different types of professions end up being implicated in these things. Or parents who say, I don't want my children to go through some kind of sex education program that's probably more suitable for a 16-year-old when they're 12. Okay, so you could think of lots of examples of the kind of opt-out approach, the conscientious objection approach. If you cannot change the wider culture and the wider laws, the general laws, this is a legitimate way of limiting their damage and of, if you like, protecting your ability to act in accordance with your conscience. It's a legitimate strategy, an important strategy. But I just want to say that it has a few downsides. The first downside is that it may be misunderstood in a relativistic culture. People may understand it as a kind of a feeling. Like, I don't want to do this because I feel bad when I do it. It makes me feel bad. Or because my conscience says I can't. Well, in the case of abortion, it's not the case that a doctor doesn't perform an abortion simply because his conscience gives him problems. It's because he believes that it's killing an innocent child. And so there can be a confusion if you claim this opt-out, that people might think it's so that you can be more comfortable with your conscience. That's not what it's about. Primarily, it's about the injustice of the practice. So that could be a misunderstanding flowing from conscience rights. Secondly, conscience rights could be multiplied. People could claim conscience rights so that children don't get blood transfusions across a range of different issues as a way of defending different decisions that may be problematic from the point of view of justice or ethics. So conscience in itself is a bit of a fluid category, and different groups can claim it. Third, conscience-based exemptions may not really provide all the protection we want for ethical conduct because, first of all, it may be that people will sort of wonder whether there's a grey area between your conscientious rights and your preferences. And there's a way in which people can turn a conscientious objection around and make it look like it's just special pleading for not providing a service. So there's rhetorically ways in which people can get around it or can kind of diffuse it. Also, do institutions have consciences? I mean, a lot of people would say that institutions and corporate entities don't have consciences. And so they'll say it's okay for you to opt out personally, but they won't give that protection to an entire institution. So that's a limitation of the conscience kind of claim or the conscience clause, opt-out clauses. And thirdly, the onus falls on the exempted to show that they qualify for the exemption to an otherwise binding law. So you have to prove sometimes if it comes to a court of law that your conscience requires this of you. It's kind of hard to either prove or disprove a conscience claim. So you would hope that courts would give the benefit of the doubt to the person claiming the conscience claim, the freedom of conscience. I think it does have one of the primary downsides I see would be that it can weaken the power of dissenting communities if they rely primarily on the right of conscience, because people start to look at them as kind of these quixotic sort of sectarian groups who are at the margins of society but would like an exception for their beliefs because they're uncomfortable with doing a particular act. And that takes out the radicalism out of their position because, as you know, like the Amish, for example, some more extreme forms of the Amish, well, they won't use electricity, for example, right? And they're quite happy to stay in their group and, you know, nobody bothers them and they stay where they are. And they don't bother society. But we don't want to be in a position where we're viewed as these sort of this sect who just kind of has these strange beliefs and people will leave us alone so we can practice our beliefs. No, we want to be a force for change. We want to bring an ethic of life into the mainstream. So that's why we need to witness to the fact that this is an injustice in society in general. It's not just that I'm defending my own conscience. It's that I want to promote life and the respect for life across society. So that's a downside of seeking conscientious kind of opt-outs. This is why I think it's so important for us to engage with mainstream institutions and culture. That means active, head-on resistance to the offending law or practice. Dissenters can actively campaign against unjust laws, contesting and practices, contesting them on their merits, protesting against them, demonstrating the dissenting community's resolve to stand against injustice no matter the cost. We are a thorn in the side of, let's say, the kind of the wider community that permits abortion. It's going to be, let's just say, a little unpleasant for people when they see us witnessing against abortion, because it makes them feel a little bit, could make them feel a bit guilty about what they're doing. And it's frankly just bothersome when people are protesting. It creates a sense of dis-ease and people are kind of uneasy. That's exactly the point. You want to put people ill at ease so that they don't become accustomed to a barbarity, right? So this is what Martin Luther King, when his civil rights in the civil rights movement in the United States, basically called defending the rights of blacks to full inclusion. He called this creative tension, a creative tension. It's not a violent tension because we don't go out in the streets with arms. It's a creative tension because what we do is we generate a tension in the wider community that becomes painful for the people involved, because obviously, you know, Irish people love to be at ease with each other. They're non-confrontational by nature, it seems to me, and they love for everyone to get on well. So for an Irish person, it's not nice when someone goes out in the street and makes a fuss. It makes them uncomfortable. But that's the point. It's supposed to make them uncomfortable. And that's what creative tension is. And there's a demand then to resolve the tension. So how do we resolve the tension? Well, you could shut up the people with the placards. You could try to get them to go home. That would be one way. Or eventually, you give them what they're looking for. That's another way of resolving the tension. So this is what many civil rights movement are aware of, this kind of technique. And we need to use that technique too. In the short term, this could mean, of course, that we are sued, that we're marginalized politically, that we're fined, or that we're even imprisoned for what we do. And that is the price sometimes for being Christian and for witnessing to the truth. And I certainly hope that I'm not put in prison for what I do. I'm in a luxurious position of teaching at a Catholic university that takes seriously the beliefs of the Catholic Church. So there's no danger of my university putting me in prison or trying to sue me for anything that I say in the university. But not everyone is in that luxurious position. Engagement is really important. So we've talked about conscientious objection and conscientious kind of, exceptions for conscientious reasons, from unjust practices, right? We've talked about conscientious objections. We've talked about critical engagement and the need to generate this creative tension and to get out there and raise the awareness of the public. There's another third strategy that I think is very important, which is developing an independent Christian culture through institutional innovation and the creation of Christian institutions. And the reason this is important is because very often when you try to engage the mainstream culture and mainstream institutions, you're up against one serious problem, and that is that those institutions are already controlled and managed by people who have very little understanding or sympathy for Christian humanism. So, for example, if you're in a school and you're a teacher in a school and you want to teach Christian humanism, or you want the principles of dignity and human life and so on, but that school is in a public system in which there is, let's say, huge pressure from the top down to bring about an aggressive form. Well, let's just say, I would say, a problematic form of sex education. There might come a point where, as a teacher, and even as a parent, you have very little ability to push back and stop that from being imposed in your school. It's possible you might find yourself, for example, in a minority, in a small minority, and that's the point where I think you need to seriously start thinking about, do we need to start setting up our own schools and freeing them from the control of the Department of Education, for example, right? Or business. Imagine you're in a business environment in which essentially they're putting out rainbows everywhere so that everyone is going to be like celebrating same-sex marriage, which I have friends who are in this position. Well, in a way, there's not much you could do about that, because like that's the CEO and the managers of the business decide that. Or imagine that you're in a medical center that forces its doctors to perform abortions and fires them if they're too pro-life. There are lots of situations in which the fact that institutions are not Christian or are not friendly to Christian humanism puts Christians and people of goodwill in a very, very vulnerable position in those institutions, and makes it very difficult to advance Christian principles in the wider culture and in the culture of those institutions. That's why I advocate the importance of, building institutions from the ground up that are inspired by a Christian spirit. Because in those institutions, could be educational institutions, it could be consulting firms in business, for example, those institutions have a real chance at, if you like, instilling a Christian ethos within the institution at large, because they choose, they have some control and over, for example, personnel, over who enters, who gets jobs in the institution, so that there's some sense in which they're able to uphold the integrity of the institution. And that institution in turn can become a training ground for future institutional leaders and staff, a virtuous circle for carrying forward a Christian culture. Because culture, I'm writing a book about this right now, culture cannot be carried forward without institutions. Culture is not something kind of in the air that sort of just you breathe. It's not just that. Culture is a set of customs, habits, narratives, collective narratives, self-understandings that gets propagated through organizations. And so you need to build organizations that will actually promote a certain kind of culture if you want that culture to survive. And so Christians, for too long, especially I would say in Ireland, we've kind of had the attitude that we just need to kind of promote the right ideas in the general society, in the wider society. Sometimes there's that idea, or campaign for the right ideas, which is fair enough. But we actually need to build institutions that reflect those ideas and advance those ideas and carry them forward to the next generation. The church is one such institution, but we need other educational institutions as well. And obviously this organization is an example of one such institution. Okay, to conclude, I've done my best to present a balanced assessment of the merits of three possible strategies for promoting a Christian culture in an anti-Christian environment. I have suggested that dissenting communities may find themselves compelled to seek out responses to injustice that fall short of full-scale social reform. Among these second best responses are measures that reduce the costs of dissent from injustice, such as conscience-based exemptions from general legal obligations. But I have also suggested that this strategy may encourage the wider society to view dissenters as harmless sects to be tolerated rather than serious interlocutors who deserve to be listened to. Secondly, I have pointed out that a more direct and confrontational style of engagement, even in a politically unfavourable climate, may be more effective than the pursuit of conscience-based exemptions at making a problem socially conspicuous and generating the sort of creative tension that Gandhi and King sought to induce in their campaigns of non-violent resistance. Nonetheless, head-on cultural engagement is unlikely to be effective unless a Christian culture is built up within independent institutions that control their own ethos and select their own staff. If we wish to pass on the heritage of Christian humanism to our children and children's children intact, we should be prepared to employ all three of these strategies as the situation demands, namely conscientious objection, engagement with the culture, and the creation of independent institutions with a Christian spirit. Thank you.